Well, last time we ended with a sober slap in the face, you might say, the brutal honesty of Psalm 88, wherein the author bemoans the absence and failure of God to be available to and for his own chosen people in times of national or personal distress. The New Testament approach to suffering and persecution and loss is very different than the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's based on the expectation that Jesus would very soon arrive as King of Kings and Lord of all. And so believers were encouraged to simply hold on, be patient, be courageous, wait just a little bit longer, and victory would be theirs. But in the Old Testament, the approach to suffering has no connection to any other end than death. In the Old Testament, they're not anticipating the return of Jesus. They know nothing about this. So for them, the end is death. And if death is the only relief from suffering that their God has not removed from their life, then numerous authors speculate about whether or not God really is faithful to his people. The New Testament, on one hand, is certain. The Old Testament is uncertain and full of doubts, other than the conviction and the message that in the end, no matter what happens in this life, it is still good to trust in the Lord. Let's continue today by stepping into that very uncomfortable world of Ecclesiastes. It shouldn't be uncomfortable, but it often is. It's not written to make people uncomfortable. It's written to enter their discomfort and to actually guide and encourage. But the moral of the story in Ecclesiastes is that not only can God not be counted on, but life plays out as one cruel joke after another. And then you die. And God is to blame. That's the message of Ecclesiastes. A very strange book to many people. A book that many wonder why it was included in the canon of the scriptures. The main speaker in the book is introduced to us right in the beginning as simply the teacher, or it could be translated preacher. The word is one who assembles, one who gathers people together in front of him or her and shares wisdom. So this is the whole point of the book. Gather around, come as real selves, not as religious people, and sit down and let me tell you something about life and about God and about your relationship to God, especially as it relates to difficulties in your life. The teacher is in what we would call major faith crisis mode. All signs indicate to him that God has orchestrated an absurd existence for us humans, and it's futile as the cycles of nature. Just think, he says, of the poor old sun. It rises and sets every day without rest, again and again and again, with nothing to show for it. No progress is made. Or, says the teacher, consider the wind. It blows this way and that, round and round in a never-ending, meaningless, tedious, pointless, futile cycle. The streams, too, never stop flowing into the sea, but the sea never fills up. It just keeps running and running and running. All that effort, says the teacher, all that effort makes zero difference. And he's suggesting that in your life, your streams, your wind, your rain, those same kind of forces never seem to make any difference. For the teacher, death neutralizes all of our toil. We can spend our whole lives accomplishing great things, making a truckload of money, owning half of downtown Calgary. But when you die, you can't take it with you. So what difference does any of it make? What's the point? You may feel a little self-righteous towards the teacher as a Christian. You may feel a little bit like, I would never write something so desperately lacking in faith. Where is this man's faith? Why is it futile? Why is the answer not trust in God and he will make everything beautiful in his time? That he makes everything perfect and he works everything out for your good. Where is his faith? We wouldn't write something this hollow and desperate and sad, would we, if we had faith? But this teacher has looked life square in the face and refused to play the religious game, suggesting that everything is really okay. Everything is working out for some higher purpose. This is a common refrain amongst Christians, that no matter what is going on in life, it's all for a purpose. It's all supposed to be that way. When people kept the Feast of Tabernacles in September and October, we would say that the hurricanes would blow through some of the church feast sites. I mean, we'd just blame Satan. We'd say, well, he must be attacking God's people. There's a purpose for this. Now I think we know that that's not the case. It's hurricane season. And we chose to put some sites in the path of hurricanes that we knew were likely to happen year after year after year. The teacher here is saying sometimes, in fact, many times, much of what happens in life has no specific purpose. It is not orchestrated by God. He didn't put it in your life for some test to see if you would stay faithful. Life just happens. Now, at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, a narrator takes over. We don't know who this person is, but it's someone who's telling the tale, and he adds his own commentary in chapter 12, verses 9 to 14. And he tells us not, don't listen to the teacher, because this man has no faith. Be more like someone else. The narrator says, listen to the teacher, because, in fact, he is wise. He's real, he's honest, but he's also actually wise. And the teacher's words are not brushed aside. There's no suggestion that they are lacking faith in any way. They are worth hearing, says the narrator, even though they are painful to hear. And in verse 11 of Ecclesiastes 12, he writes, the sayings of the wise, the person you've just listened to for 12 chapters, the sayings of the wise are like goads, not goats, goads. A goad is a long stick with a nail on the end that's used to poke sheep to tell them to go this way and not that way. It's used to correct. It's used to guide. It's used to steer. And the narrator says that the wise man you've just listened to moan and complain and sound so desperately lost and confused and uncertain, that man is actually giving you wise words that will steer you in life, that will guide you in life, and you won't get burnt out by a false sense of expectation of certainty, by a false expectation that God will always dive into your life and straighten it out and make it easy for you. So somehow this teacher that seems to a Christian mind to be lacking faith is actually a man very much of faith, of the real kind of faith that isn't cast down to a point where he can't recover. The narrator says that the teachings are words that hurt like a shepherd's goad, but he's not trying to tame the previous 11 chapters. He's not trying to modify them. The teacher's words hurt like a nail on the end of a stick, but they're supposed to, is what he's saying. The narrator continues, even though the teacher's words are wise, we are not to live in that mindset, that same headspace perpetually, brooding about life, rehashing it over and over and over again. So everything that he has talked about, everything the teacher has expressed about the reality of feeling like life is futile and God is not even there, the narrator is saying, you will likely have times in your life when you are there, when you feel like that. But don't stay there. Ecclesiastes 12, 12 to 13. He says, of the making of many books, this would suggest books that try to bring certainty into everything in life. Books that tell you how it should be. Books that tell you how great it is to be a child of God because you'll never suffer again. You'll never be confused again. You'll have all the answers. You'll know everything now. And of much study, particularly of theology and doctrine and scripture and religious poetry, there is weariness of flesh. The end of the matter is that all has been heard, all of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the narrator says at the end of it all, fear God, keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone. Well, what would the other duty be? The other duty is the things that people think they're supposed to do. The other duty on people's minds is that they think they have to figure it all out. They think they have to have certainty. They think they need to be able to give an answer to every question that life could possibly pose before them. They think they need to be able to find where God is in the whirlwind and in the storm and when things are confusing and difficult. And the reality is, fear God, keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty. You don't have to understand it all. You don't have to know everything. He's saying that obsessing about life and trying to work it all out is spiritually and emotionally exhausting. And so, the book of Ecclesiastes says, stop. No more words. No more debating. No more arguing about theology and doctrine and what's God doing and where is God and what is God. Nothing more, he says, needs to be said. You know how to live your life. Just go do it. He's saying that regardless of your life circumstances, regardless of your personal individual understanding of God and your relationship to God, reverence and obedience have always been the mark of a faithful Israelite, not your pure and packaged belief system. Even when life is absurd and only death waits for us at the other end, he says, fear God and live obediently before God anyway. So when we reach the point where things simply make no sense, when our thinking about God and life no longer line up with what we think we're supposed to think or what it used to think or what the church told us it was and then changed, when any sense of certainty is gone, and when we can find no reason to trust God, but we still do, that is what trust looks like at its brightest, when all else is dark. The book of Ecclesiastes is not a drawn-out, sorry tale of a lack of faith. It's about not knowing, not understanding, not having all the answers, and being okay with that. It's an honest reflection of what people of faith really experience. And again, if you haven't experienced any of these feelings, these expressions that the book is talking about, then I'm happy for you. But I doubt there are too many who would raise their hands. But wait a minute. Isn't the Bible itself supposed to be the answer book? Isn't that supposed to be certainty? The place you turn to when you have questions? And then when you look into that book, you find the answers, and we all agree it's the answer, and we all share the same solutions to life's problems because we've all been through them before, and we just point to solution chapter 400, verse 5. Because it is the answer book, isn't it? Doesn't the Bible tell us how important it is to believe the right, correct, certain thing about God? Well, Peter ends, the author of the book that I'm basing this material on currently, says, what do you mean by believe? Think of how we use the word believe when we talk about our faith. We say things like, here's what I believe in. The other person might say, really? I don't believe those things. I believe different things to you. I believe some of the things you believe, but I have a different belief about that. I might have a different belief about which day to go to church on. I might believe that it's not okay to welcome homosexuals into my home, and you might believe that you can. You might believe that you shouldn't keep Christmas, and I might believe that it's perfectly fine. So with your beliefs, you wouldn't be welcome in my church, and you certainly, with those beliefs, would not be welcome to marry my daughter. That's how we use the word believe. It's the things that we think. It's the content of the things that we believe in. To us, it's a thinking word. It's a describing word for the content of our thoughts. I believe that God exists. I believe that God created the world. I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, etc., etc. And all along, we're misusing the word because its primary use is not a what do you believe, not that which you believe. It is who you believe. Belief is about who, not what you believe in the Bible. And if we forget that, then we read into the Bible our own tendency to put what we believe at the heart of belief, which sets us up to be preoccupied with, once again, that dirty word, correct thinking, otherwise known as orthodoxy. And that completely misses the point. If what we believe is central, and we are certain about what we believe, we will be at odds. Before we even met the people we're at odds with, we will be one of these people, and that defines us as not any of those people. So we're against those people. Even if we love them anyway, we are opposed to that set of beliefs. If who we believe is the same as who they believe, even if we understand that who differently, then there is no opposition. There is unity. It's easy to hold ideas and opinions and points of view and teachings as beliefs. But if you hold opinions, points of views, and teachings as beliefs, then you have no reason to put your trust and your faith in those teachings, as if they were teachings that had never changed. You can't put your trust in something that tomorrow may be different. You can't keep changing your trust. It's always interesting to me that when we talk about beliefs, we're so convicted of those things in so many cases that we don't even allow in our head the possibility that they could be wrong, even though there are a majority of other people who think differently. We don't call them our opinions about God, do we? We call them doctrines. We call them creeds. We say they are statements of faith. And they're your opinions, or the opinions of someone else that you agree with. But if we actually call them what they are, which is our opinion, our point of view or how we understand something, it would completely change the discussion. Because I can't impose my point of view. What right do I have to say that your point of view, if it's different, is inferior to mine? Trust doesn't have any wiggle room. You either trust all in or you don't. And if you trust all in something that could change, it makes it very shaky. And it makes you very defensive of those things because you don't want them to change. Because then your trust has been in something that turns out to be false. But again, if we think of belief as a who, not a what, then that who can remain consistent in our life. When we say that someone has faith, we run into the same potential problem as when we talk about belief. We might say to someone, tell me about your faith. And the answer might be something like this. Well, my faith includes the belief that I'm a Christian, that Jesus is the Son of God who died for my sins, and so on. I'm a member of the Christian faith, and these are the things that we believe in our faith. But again, faith in the New Testament is typically not about the content of what you believe, but about trusting God and acting on it. Faith describes our whole way of looking at life and what we do about that. And the goal of life is to become holy, right? I mean, ultimately, if you could pick one single thing, what's the point of life? What are you aiming for in life? At the end of it, what would you hope to have achieved? Yes, you'd like to have a warm, loving family, a lot of friends, a comfortable lifestyle, good health. But beyond all of those things, on a higher plane, is it not to be a holy person? To be godlike, you might say. To be sanctified. To have lived a good life. And so, if that is the goal, to be pure in thought and action, to be selfless, authentically loving and demonstrating grace, if that is the highest goal, to have lived a life well in those areas, then to be successful means to become God-like, more like God. And we are most like God, and notice this carefully, we are most like God not when we can quantify exactly our set of beliefs about God, or when we can tell others how correct our theology is and how incorrect theirs is, but when we are acting towards one another like the faithfulness of God towards us. Not the content of your theology. Not the content of what you believe God to be. Humility, love, and kindness are our grandest acts of faithfulness. If you believe this is how God has acted towards you, and you can get to the end of your life and say, I've lived a life, and at the end of my life, I'm confused about theology. I'm uncertain about my belief system. But I can say I have grown in humility, love, sacrifice, surrender, kindness to others, and expressing grace. If I can say that, those are the highest acts of faithfulness. In 1 John 4:13, the author writes, no one has ever seen God. So we know that. No one can point and say, yeah, I met God in this place one time and he looked like this and he acted like this. He's saying God is invisible. God is an idea, a concept that is so beyond our understanding that we wonder what God is like. And so John says, if we love one another, then whatever God is, God lives in us, or is alive in us, some translations say. And his love is perfected in us. Why is that not enough? Why do we demand certainty beyond this? John is saying, you can have debates all day long about your theology and your doctrine and your creeds and when is Jesus coming back. He said, what are you doing today? If you want to experience God, the closest thing you will ever have in seeing God is loving each other. So have you done that? Have you done that before you start fighting amongst yourselves about your belief system, your statement of faith? Unfortunately, when we fight about our statements of faith and our theology, we're not doing the very one thing that is identified as the act that would cause us to see God more than any other act. It's not in our heads. It's not how much we think we know God better than someone else knows God. Being acceptable to God is much more about the thoughts we keep in our heads, the belief system we hold on to, or the doctrines we recite, or the statements of faith we adhere to. No matter how fervently and genuinely we hold on to those things, being obsessed with making sure that we have all of our thoughts about God properly arranged and defended vigorously is not faith. How trusting are we of God day to day, and how godlike we live among those around us day to day is faith. The very famous passage in James 2:14 to 18. James writes, "What good is it, my brothers and sisters?" Really, what good is it if someone claims to have faith, they know all the right things, they know what they believe in, they know that they can trust what they believe to be true, but they have no deeds? Can such faith save them? And the rhetorical answer is no. No, if there's no deeds, if you claim to have faith in the love of God for you, but you have no love for others, I can't save you. Suppose, and he gives a very concrete example. Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food, and one of you says to them, "Go in peace. Off you go. Be warm and well fed. I'll pray for you. That's what I'll do, because I believe that God will provide for you. And I have food to share, but you're not getting that. That's for me. That's mine. Hands off. I worked for that. You didn't do anything for that. You're probably in need because you're lazy. You're probably in need because you didn't trust God, or it's a punishment, or you're being punished, and I don't want to interfere in God's punishment for you. I got to let it run its course. Be well, be filled somehow, somewhere." No, says James, absolutely not. It does nothing about their physical needs, then what good is it? In the same way, he says, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is actually dead. Having a perfect belief system, having a pure theology, as if there were such a thing and there isn't, but if there were and you have it, he says it does nothing. Paul said the same thing in 1 Corinthians. You can be a prophet, you can speak in tongues, you can have all sorts of spiritual gifts, but if you have love, you have nothing. This is the central message of the New Testament. It is the new commandment that Jesus gave. Why is it not the central focus of every single Christian church worldwide? Not in their talk, in their action, above and beyond everything by far. James says, "Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by my deeds." I don't need to talk about what I believe. I don't need to talk about how much better my thoughts are, my beliefs are than you. I need to show you my deeds. Not in a bragging way, but you will see my deeds. You will know the kind of person, not by my talk, but by my action. And if James is correct, then we completely miss the point of what the biblical writers are telling us if we think of belief and faith as correct thinking words, as orthodox words. These are deep and hard words that move us deeper and into the understanding of the need to reflect the way of God, even more than some static theology about God. Peter Ains goes on to say, being certain of what you believe and expecting the Bible to provide that information sounds like a spiritual safety net. I mean, it's tempting, isn't it? To just say, the answer's in the Bible somewhere. I just need to find it. Yet how could there possibly be an answer when you say, why am I dying of cancer? Where is this in the Bible? Where does it say? So you try to find someone else who was ill and found some justice in there or found some good that came out of it. Instead of saying, we all die. We all get sick. Eventually, the cancer is the leading cause of death. Period. So most people will die of cancer at some point. Between cancer and heart attack, heart disease, that's how most people die. That's Ecclesiastes' point of view. We're all dying, so why would we look to the Bible to try to make sense of something that already makes sense? It makes sense that we're finite human beings and that this is going to be the end for all of us a long, long time from now. Many, many decades from now, of course. But some people don't, they view the Bible as somehow needing to give an explanation and a rationale for everything that's going on in their life. And it's not written like that. He says, what happens when the Bible becomes a source of trouble and doubt instead of certainty? Not a source of certainty, but a cause for questioning what you had been so certain about in the past. He says, our universe, or to be precise, the known universe, is about 13.8 billion years old. It is 546, this is just the known universe, 546 sextillion miles across. That is 546 followed by 20 zeros. Wow. Traveling at the speed of light, and anyone know what the speed of light is?
36,000.
Whoa. Andrew, are you certain about that? 186,282 miles per second. That's the speed of light. Traveling at that speed across our known universe would take 93 billion years to go from one end to the other. This universe contains billions of galaxies, with each one containing billions of stars that are millions of light years apart. Add to all this the notion that about 85% of the universe is made up of something that we refer to as dark matter, because we don't know what it is. It's not matter like earth and water. Our home planet, as Carl Sagan put it, is a pale blue dot, precious to us, but of incalculable insignificance on the grand cosmic scale. So, I ask you, where is God in all that? Is where even a legitimate question? Is God a being? Or is it better to say, as some theologians are now saying, God is being? And if God is being, what do we do with the biblical God, who is definitely presented as a person-like deity who sits enthroned in a static heaven? Who or what is this God exactly? Now, wouldn't you like a certain answer to that? Wouldn't you like to know? Wouldn't you like it if I could tell you I know exactly the answer to that question? You may think you know the answer, than Norma would. You may think you know the answer to that question. But what you know is your explanation to that question. What does the God of the inexplicably infinitely large and infinitesimally small have to do with the God of the Bible, who seems preoccupied with tribal skirmishes, making sure that his people don't eat shrimp and pork, and who demands his people maintain a rigorous schedule of sacrifice to him? Humans have been around a long time doing human-like things, far longer, more widespread, and more complex than the simple stories in Genesis. We have ancient art in the form of cave drawings from 40,000 years ago. In Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, archaeologists uncovered the oldest currently known temple. And whomever these people were, whoever they were worshiping, some deity or deities, they were doing so about 11,000 years ago, predating creation in the Bible by 5,000 years. So how they got there, I don't know. We know of cave paintings in Mongolia that depict wrestling matches from 7,000 years ago. According to the first chapter of the Bible, the cosmos at that time was still wrapped in a soupy, primordial, chaotic ocean, or deep, as it's referred to. The Sumerians in modern-day Iraq were brewing beer 6,000 years ago, around the same time when the Bible says God created light. So how does the Bible, the God of the Bible, fit into reality, into archaeology, into science, into astronomy? That question challenges modern-day Christians as no generation before. Neurobiologists are currently mapping the brain and are able to reproduce human emotions in laboratories, including those associated with worshiping God. Are we then simply a mass of chemicals and neurons that have evolved over millions upon millions of years of adaptation? Are humans simply an evolved species with particular adaptive functions like art and abstract reasoning that Christians have mistakenly been calling the image of God? Many perfectly average Christians, including pastors and professors, have been helped more by therapists and Lexapro, which is an anti-anxiety and anti-depression drug, more by those than by prayer, Bible reading, or some form of Christian Bible-based counseling that emphasizes sin and the need for repentance. And if healing wounds and helping people live fulfilling and meaningful lives can be addressed through skilled counseling, group support, and medication, then why do we need God and the Bible or the Quran? Does Jesus really make a difference? Or are we better off with a health plan that covers therapy and prescription medication? Ironically, most Christians who look to God for healing still take the pills and the supplements and the vaccinations and the surgeries and the therapies to make them feel well. So they don't really expect God to provide wholeness. We look to the medical and psychological answers offered by society. So what part does God play? Why pray to this God and then do what we would have done if we didn't believe in a God? These sort of questions come up in the modern world awash in genuine, documented, therapeutic successes and pharmacological advances. And we'll begin to answer those questions next time.